From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. If the feds want to legally tap your phone, they A, persuade a judge to give them a warrant, B, present that warrant to the phone company, and C, the phone company activates the tap. Easy peasy, a practice codified in a 1994 law known as CALEA. But these days, tech-savvy criminals and terrorists and pretty much everybody else use Skype and encrypted BlackBerries and Google and Facebook. What's old-school law enforcement to do? This week, the New York Times revealed a White House plan to be proposed next year that would force all the 21st-century communications networks to construct the same wiretap capabilities that now exist for the phone. Charlie Savage, Washington correspondent for The Times, broke the story this week, and he says that even if the proposal results in legislation, it could be an incredibly difficult law to implement.
If the service is located on servers that are overseas, it's not subject to a U.S. court order. If they're using a form of encryption, that means that even the service provider can't say what this data is. Or if it's a peer-to-peer software like Skype, there is no central place to go and capture all that data.
If you build a back door into these various networks that the government has access to, it seems to me that every hacker and his brother, not to mention foreign governments, would try to enter the same back door, no?
If you create a security hole for a lawful purpose, it's inevitable, the critics say, that it will be exploited for unlawful purposes. Greece has a law that requires its phone systems to be wiretappable, and in 2005 it was discovered that somebody, still unknown, had hacked into that capacity, forwarding copies of cell phone calls of about 100 top officials to an unknown phone where they could be listened to, including the prime minister's phone.
So here's another potential objection. On the one hand, it's a little nerve-wracking that a terrorism investigation could be slowed down by weeks or months because of having to retrofit a communication service with tappability capability. On the other hand, should I be nervous that the federal government would have one-step access to all of these communications? Aren't they just destined to abuse it?
Well, the privacy rights and civil liberties activist community certainly have that view. They like the idea of some communication streams between individuals being beyond the reach of government intrusion. The government's rebuttal is, look, we're not talking about getting into the contents of these communications without court orders. We're talking about cases where you go to a judge and you say, look, I've got the following evidence. I think this person's communication should be looked at. And the judge independently agrees or doesn't. And only after that authority is granted would this be exercised.
If this technology is built into every communications platform and its brother, presumably that means that governments like Iran and China and Burma would be able to go in through the same back doors.
You still have to have some sort of leverage if you're government X over a service provider to get them to provide the communications. That's hard to do when the service is operating from servers that are outside of your borders. But one person suggested to me that once the United States requires everyone to have a server here capable of decrypting communications, it will be no time at all before every other country in the world demands the same deal, making the same arguments.
And now we're talking about an enormous increase in cost. A gigantic company with all sorts of cash flow will have no problem submitting to the government's wishes. Startups, small companies, undercapitalized companies, in other words, most of the new players into the technology sector, maybe don't have the wherewithal to set up offices in 200-some countries.
This is in some ways a replay of the arguments in the 90s over that 1994 law that required phone companies to build in these kinds of intercept capabilities. There was, number one, a lot of fears expressed that that would impede cell phone innovation and further developments. And there was a lot of jostling between rival companies to try to get the regulations as they were written in a way that would help them raise barriers to entry for future rivals.
What's been the reaction to your story? And how different do you suppose the reaction would have been had this proposal been floated during the notoriously overreaching George Bush administration?
This is different from some of the surveillance scandals of the Bush administration. This is something that is being proposed through the lens of, let's go to Congress and get them to adjust the laws to do what we want to do, not this is something that we can do unilaterally in defiance of congressional statutes or approval. Republicans, who have generally been pro-national security when it comes to the security versus privacy trade-off, aren't criticizing it. And Democrats, who want to support the administration, don't see this as a fruitful thing to bang the drum about, where it might have been fruitful for that purpose when the Republicans were in charge of the White House. And finally, this is, the FBI at least would argue, not an attempt to gain new power to wiretap. It is an attempt to keep existing power to wiretap from eroding due to technological change.
All right. Charlie, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Charlie Savage is a Washington correspondent for The New York Times. His piece, U.S. Tries to Make It Easier to Wiretap the Internet, ran in Monday's New York Times.
Last weekend, Iran's official news agency reported that the country's new Bushehr nuclear reactor had been hit by a piece of malicious software, or malware, called Stuxnet. The malware is specifically designed to infiltrate software manufactured by the company Siemens, software that monitors automated industrial processes in refineries, water towers, and yes, nuclear power plants. Discovered in June by a cybersecurity firm, Stuxnet sent a chill through the security community because it's unprecedented in its complexity, implying that it must have a lot of money and talent behind it. The worm's sophistication and the high concentration of infections in Iran have led many in the media to suggest that it was deliberately targeted at Iranian nuclear facilities by a foreign foe.
Computer security specialists say the Stuxnet worm apparently was created by a government somewhere.
It is theoretically possible that the U.S. government did this. More likely, frankly, is Israel.
Pentagon tonight refusing to say whether United States government programmers created a powerful computer worm, one that's apparently targeted Iran's nuclear facilities.
This enticing story of international espionage fits neatly in the narrative of strained relationships between Iran and the West, but cybersecurity specialist Bruce Schneier says that not only don't we know who or what Stuxnet was designed to attack, we aren't even sure what it does yet.
Stuxnet's job right now is primarily to spread itself. Its writers, its controllers, can change what it does. It can be reprogrammed on the fly. And in a sense, that's the greatest danger. We don't know what it's going to do.
Is it rare for a piece of software to actually cause physical damage to the hardware of a computer?
Most worms just go after information. Certainly, today's worms infect computers that in turn affect real-world systems. You'll see worms infecting computers that might drop a control system in a hospital, in a police station. These aren't deliberate. You know, these tend to be accidental. Right? This seems a little different in that it is deliberately attacking these control systems, and we don't know why.
What sort of damage could this worm do?
You know, it's a hard question and probably a not very valuable question. It's certainly fun to talk about the worst possible case, but the worst possible case isn't the likely case, and it just makes people scared for no good reason.
Wait a second. This worm has gone into this facility. There's got to be a reason why.
Well, I mean, there are worms all the time, and they go into nuclear power plants all the time and other valuable facilities. This isn't a targeted missile. It's a worm that's wandering around the planet, infecting computers it can find. Among the many countries Stuxnet infected, one of them is Iran. And you can put it first on the list, but it's like claiming because your house got snowed on that the snow is intended to find your house. It's snowing all over town. I mean, stop taking it personally.
There is a security expert named Ralph Langner who, after doing some reverse engineering of the program, posted on his website what he found, including a section he called completely speculative, which supposed that Stuxnet must have come from the West.
Langner's blog postings were really very good, and he made sure to say that his theories were just theories and speculation. As the media started replaying those, they got more the air of fact, even though there was no new evidence to support them.
If there's no proof that this was created by a nation state, why do you think the newspapers have so heavily implied that it was?
I think there's a good story here. I think a government riding a worm to attack an Iranian nuclear power plant plays into the politics of today, plays into our fears of cyber war. So it's a good story to repeat.
Maybe the U.S., even if it didn't build Stuxnet, is deriving some benefit from not denying it, because if it erodes Iranian confidence in its nuclear infrastructure, that might be useful.
I think the Israelis are playing the same game too, not denying that they wrote it because there's political advantage. I mean, and that makes a lot of sense, right? Once something's out there, you might as well take advantage of it for your policy goals. You mentioned that because of its complexity, some people theorize it can only be written by a government. I think the notion that complexity equals government is overstated. I mean, you think about the most complex pieces of software out in the world. They're not written by governments. They're written by corporations. Now that this code is out there, anybody with the skill, and it does require skill, but it still can be done, can reverse engineer it, can modify it, can learn from it, can improve it, and re-release it.
So what are we to learn from Stuxnet, if anything?
Well, we're to learn that the motivations behind worms are hard to discern. We know there's a class of criminal worms that have a very obvious profit motive. And then there are these worms that are out there that don't have obvious profit motives. And there are groups writing them and releasing them for some reason. And we don't know if these are government cyber warriors doing tests. We don't know if these are criminals with some new money-making idea. We don't know if they're governments or spy organizations or commercial spy organizations. We just don't know.
Why can't we know?
We don't know because you can't figure out human intent from computer code.
Bruce, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bruce Schneier is an author and computer security specialist.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In 2001, Craigslist created a separate category on its website called Erotic Services, later renamed Adult Services. In addition to posting apartments for rent or sofas for sale, this site now facilitated sex, presumably between consenting adults. Of course, sex for money is prostitution, so many who solicited there used the word roses as a kind of code for dollars, or simply offered a, quote, massage or companionship. And so it went for 9 years, until early last month, when Craigslist closed down the service amid pressure from government prosecutors and child advocates.
An anti-human trafficking group calls Craigslist the Walmart of the online sex trade.
Craigslist has abruptly shut down its controversial adult services section.
A Craigslist executive was summoned to answer for the charges of creating an invitation to trafficking.
The site, many contended, was abetting not only prostitution, but the trafficking of minors. Michelle Goldberg is an author and columnist for The Daily Beast. She wrote about the campaign against the Craigslist adult service section in The Daily Beast. Michelle, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So your piece in The Daily Beast is called The Woman Who Beat Craigslist. Who is she?
Well, her name is Malika Sadersar, and she's the founder of a group called The Rebecca Project, which works with some of the most underprivileged and at-risk girls and young women in the country. And she was doing a project really focusing on women in the juvenile justice system. And what she found was that the vast majority of girls who were in the juvenile justice system, sexual abuse, prostitution, or otherwise played some role. Either they were busted in prostitution arrests and sent to prison, which is insane in the case of juveniles, or else they ran away from home to escape abuse and then were picked up by pimps. They missed school because of some kind of sexual abuse and were then arrested for truancy. But in each case, these girls were victims. And what she found in talking to them, and she held focus groups all over the country, is that the majority of those who had been involved in prostitution had been bought and sold on Craigslist.
The majority?
The majority. And I heard that from other people when I was reporting this story. I heard from somebody who used to work at the New York Division of Criminal Justice Services. He said most of the domestic trafficking cases that he saw involved Craigslist.
So once Malika Sadrasar made the connection between these sexually exploited girls and specifically Craigslist, she tried to get the attention of Craigslist founder Craig Newmark. Her organization bought a big ad in the San Francisco Chronicle, right?
Right. And it featured letters from two girls who had been trafficked through Craigslist. One of them had hooked up with a much older man who she thought was her boyfriend, and he had trafficked her at truck stops, basically renting her out by the hour. She said sometimes 10 men in a night. There was another girl who at 11 was being pimped out by a much older man who had several young girls and called himself Daddy Daycare. She said that they would spend all day updating their ads on Craigslist, responding to solicitations via Craigslist, basically addressing Craig Newmark personally. These girls said, "We know that you are a good guy, an idealistic guy. Please do something about it."
What happened?
For a company, again, that is pretty progressive and pretty savvy, Craigslist has been so tone deaf about this. There was a really defensive response from CEO Jim Buckmaster, in which he basically seemed to say, if these crimes happened, where are the police reports that matched the circumstances that these girls described? He later said, well, we just wanted to know if Craigslist was involved, how to rectify it. But it seems obvious to me that if you thought there was even a smidgen of a chance that these stories were true, whether or not you agree with their remedies, the first thing you say is, I am so, so sorry that Craigslist had any part of this thing that happened to you. There was a bizarre kind of coldness and lack of remorse and empathy in most of their responses throughout this process.
And they also have a material argument. They say that shutting down their adult services will simply shift that traffic to other websites that are far less scrupulous.
Their argument, which makes sense to a degree, is that Craigslist potentially could provide a more fertile ground for law enforcement. They started last year manually reviewing all of the ads on adult services sites. And they also say we take credit card numbers, so we're able to track people. Experts on the other side are saying that Craigslist has increased prostitution. Certainly, people who are determined to buy sex are going to do it, but there also might be people on both ends, both the buyer's ends and the seller's ends, who maybe won't do it if it's not so easy and so available.
She didn't make much headway with Craigslist, and she enlisted the help of the government instead.
That's right. She went to Eric Holder, who met also with one of the young women who had told her story in this advertisement. They met with Valerie Jarrett.
Valerie Jarrett, the presidential advisor.
That's right. And they also helped organize hearings in the House of Representatives about trafficking and about the role that Craigslist plays in trafficking. And eventually, Craigslist bowed to pressure, but it did it in a somewhat defiant way. It took off the adult services section and just replaced it with the word censored.
You know, you mentioned how defensive and defiant Craigslist was in responding to this situation, but the commentary has also been a little strange.
What's strange about this discussion is the way that a story about very young adolescents who were forced into prostitution and as a result ended up in the criminal justice system so quickly changed into a discussion about empowered professionals. This very, very small and unrepresentative elite of kind of happy hookers, that was who people wanted to focus on. Those people certainly make the libertarian argument more convincing and more valid, but it really allows all of us to gloss over the extent to which new technologies, as you know, wonderful and liberating as they might be, also can assist in the victimization of very, very powerless people.
Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Michelle Goldberg is an author and columnist for The Daily Beast. Her piece, The Woman Who Beat Craigslist, appears this week in The Daily Beast.
Sarah Palin, Mike Huckabee, Rick Santorum, and Newt Gingrich. What do those four names have in common? Well, for starters, they're all Republican politicians who are rumored to be eyeing the presidency in 2012. But that's not all. They are also all current employees of Fox News, which for the upcoming election raises a host of issues, from conflict of interest to equal access for other news outlets. Politico's Jonathan Martin says the situation is further complicated by the bipartisan ritual of candidates feigning uncertainty before officially entering the race.
Fox says they will sever ties with the candidates if and when those candidates declare for office. But as folks in politics well know, there is a significant gray area in between the time when a candidate begins to think about running for office and actually declares for office. So I think the central question here, which Fox wouldn't answer for us and which the candidates wouldn't answer for us, is what happens in January, February of 2011 when some of these folks are visiting the early states, they're testing the waters, and they're still on Fox's payroll.
So there's a number of ethical issues and just nuts and bolts of reporting issues attendant to this situation. One is that by terms of their contract, these four presumed candidates actually cannot show up on any other news venue. They can't be on ABC. They can't be on CNN. They've declined to talk to C-SPAN, for heaven's sake,
right?
Because they're absolutely exclusive to Fox. So how do you cover a presumed candidate if you have no access to them?
Well, you have to either air their appearances at public events, or you just have to pick up what they said on Fox, where they're getting a little scrutiny because they're on the staff. In my reporting, I talked to folks inside the network who were deeply uncomfortable with what is going on because it obviously puts them in a very tough position. On the news side, they have to deal with those candidates or potential candidates that are not being paid by Fox, who are complaining about equal access and about what it means for the campaign. They're going to be running against candidates that are Fox employees.
There's an even more disturbing wrinkle, and that is that now presumed candidates are literally on the payroll. So not only do they have the benefit of Fox's audience to campaign for free, they actually get paid to do so. At some point, does this amount to an in-kind contribution to a political campaign?
Well, that's the word that came up when I was talking to one longtime GOP strategist who is not involved yet in the campaign, was in-kind contribution. There is no question that having that Fox News platform is perhaps the most coveted sort of pulpit for any potential GOP presidential aspirant. There is no better way to communicate directly and with really little filter, too, to the kind of voters that are going to decide the next nominee of their party.
But what about the flip side of that question? What about the notion that Fox's audience is already so hardcore that by staying within the comforts of home, these candidates actually surrender access to the audience that will make the difference in the election?
That's a great question. And I think that if one of them does win the nomination, they would almost certainly have to broaden their media availability beyond Fox News to reach a broader audience. But I think that what's important is that for now, looking toward the primary, this is sort of a Fox primary.
Clearly, Fox News Channel is the sort of house organ of, they would probably say, conservative thought. I would say the Republican Party and maybe increasingly the Tea Party.
Right.
Has Fox boxed itself into the point that they actually could lose accreditation as a bona fide journalistic organization?
In some ways, they enjoy the scrutiny. It makes their point that somehow everybody else is biased and they're the ones that are only truly fair and balanced. So in some sort of odd way, they actually benefit from those kind of attacks, and it just draws more conservative viewers to them. I think that they're bottom line driven, and if it seems like what they're doing, pushing the envelope, is hurting them financially, maybe then they'll sort of reassess. But until that point, I think they're going to keep on doing it.
Okay. Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Jonathan Martin is a senior political writer at Politico.
So what do you expect when you're watching campaign ads? The obligatory shot of candidates with their smiling faces, scenes of them mingling with just plain folks, and inevitably, in the negative ads, incriminating news clips of their opponents.
But if Fox News wins its recent lawsuit, you'll be seeing less of that news footage. The network has sued the campaign of Robin Carnahan, a Missouri Democrat running for the Senate, for a TV ad her campaign created. The ad shows her opponent, Republican Roy Blunt, in a deer-in-the-headlights interview with Fox's Chris Wallace.
And your campaign committees paid $485,000 to a firm linked to lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Are you the one to clean up the house?
Roy Blunt, the very worst of Washington.
Fox says that the Carnahan campaign shouldn't be allowed to use their footage, that the ad violates its copyright and represents a threat to its reputation for objectivity. Fordham Law School professor Sonia Katyal has written about the case for Slate. She thinks this lawsuit could change how political ads look in the future. Sonia, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Fox says that the use of the clip in the ad misleadingly suggests that the reporter doing the interview, Chris Wallace, or that the network had endorsed Carnahan, and that this suggestion undermines the network's objectivity. But the Carnahan campaign says that, first of all, Blunt, who is Carnahan's opponent, has used Fox footage in his own ads with no objection from the network. What's more, Fox's parent company, News Corp, recently made a $1 million donation to the Republican Governors Association, not to mention a donation to Blunt himself. So you got to wonder whether objectivity is really what the network is defending with this lawsuit, or its brand as pro-Republican.
I agree with that. I mean, I think we have a news organization that, you're entirely right, has made very strongly partisan claims on behalf of one of the candidates and against the other. The introduction, however, of copyright into the very complex world of campaigns is definitely something that is new. One of the strongest ways in which copyright has periodically entered campaigns has been when musicians object to the use of their songs. So a few years ago, Jackson Browne threatened to sue McCain for the use of the song Running on Empty, similar issue involving Hart's Barracuda. Bruce Springsteen in 1984 objected to the use of one of his songs at a New Jersey rally for Ronald Reagan. And typically in those instances, the political campaign decides, okay, you're right, we shouldn't use this song, or we should license the rights to use the song. But another way in which copyright has entered into political campaigns has been in one particular case that also happened in 2004, where a group of students got wind of a cache of information that demonstrated the fallibility of the electronic voting machines for Diebold. And they put up the information on the web. And Diebold threatened, under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, for the students to take down the information. And the students did so, but what they also did was set up an entire network of students across the country. And we talk about this in our book, Property Outlaws, where they just kept putting up the information from school to school to school.
This is information that basically indicted Diebold for voting tallies that were insecure and manipulatable, correct?
Yes, yes.
What you're talking about is just so reminiscent of what happened during the Pentagon Papers. There was an injunction placed against the New York Times, so then the Post did it, the injunction against the Post, and then on and on throughout more than a dozen American newspapers.
Yes. One of the great things about the observation that you just made is to really think about how, if copyright could be used as a sword to really suppress political content and suppress information that the public really desires, what the results might be in terms of what our news reporting would look like. And in the end, the students actually won. They refused to back down. They wound up being represented by the Stanford Fair Use Clinic. They sued on their own behalf. Diebold backed down and actually wound up having to pay their lawyer's fees. So it's a great example of how, at times, a little bit of challenge can go a really long way.
So what do you think will happen in this case?
My sense is that once we actually have a court taking a look at the merits of the case, it will most likely find in favor of fair use. One of the things that's really important to keep in mind is that political campaign commercials are not really considered to be commercial speech. They're more likely to be considered political speech. And so the allegations that there's any sort of commercial effect on Fox really don't hold that much water. The main issue, I think, for Fox is really an issue of brand reputation, that it doesn't want its content being used in support of a Democratic candidate. And that's not the kind of injury that copyright is really designed to rectify. Copyright is designed to rectify injuries that have to do with someone copying content and making money from that content. The use of a news clip in a campaign commercial, it's a little bit of a different context.
So lay out the stakes here. What happens if the court decides this time that Fox is right?
The way that I think it would go if a court decided to rule in favor of Fox would be that suddenly individuals who were making campaign commercials would have to consider licensing all news clips that they relied on, potentially all headlines, potentially all content that drew on news organizations. And the consequences of that would be staggering. And when we think about the effect on the high cost of political campaigns now, adding this additional cost would probably leave a lot more poorly financed candidates unable to really prepare effective campaign commercials because they would be saddled with tremendous licensing costs.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Professor Sonia Katyal teaches intellectual property law at Fordham University. She wrote about the lawsuit for Slate with her co-author, Professor Eduardo M. Peñalver.
This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care, on the web at aecf.org. LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to help reverse the childhood obesity epidemic at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. And now, an old scandal gets new life. In 2006, journalist Clive Goodman and private investigator Glenn Mulcair, working for Rupert Murdoch's London tabloid News of the World, were caught illegally accessing the voicemail messages of the royal family. This invasion of privacy was just another tactic in Britain's bare-knuckle tabloid war, and when the two men pled guilty, it seemed that the case was closed. That is, until a recent New York Times Magazine article nudged the affair back into the limelight with some new developments. First, many more phones were hacked than was originally thought. Second, there is renewed scrutiny of Scotland Yard's investigation into the affair, which had been mysteriously curtailed. Third, the editor of the News of the World at the time, Andy Coulson, who denied knowledge of the hacking, has since become the communications director for the UK's new prime minister, David Cameron. Steve Hewlett is a columnist for The Guardian newspaper and host of The Media Show on the BBC. Steve, welcome to OTM.
Howdy.
So this story seems to begin with one reporter and a private dick he was working with hacking the cell phones of some royals. Who did they hack? How did they do it?
They hacked into the mobile voice mailboxes of some close royal aides. That's aides to Prince William and Harry. Because most people don't change the factory default settings on their voice mailboxes, you know, it's 0000 or 43s or 49s, whatever it is. In one sense, this was not very hard, and there is reason to think that lots of people, private detectives, journalists and others, were doing it. Now, it was made illegal by the Regulation of Investigative Powers Act of 2000, and it was subsequent to that act that Glenn Mulcair, the private detective, and Clive Goodman, the News of the World's royal editor, were caught doing it.
And convicted, and did they go to jail?
Yes, convicted, went to jail, and then when they emerged from jail, signed deals with News International for money, sort of severance deals, which had silence clauses in them. The New York Times comes along and restarts the whole thing with the number of people, 91, I think it was, where the police had found both their mobile number and their PIN number in the possession of Mulcair. Many of these people, of course, had not been told by the police that they might have been hacked. So two questions arise following the New York Times. First of all, new questions about whether Coulson could possibly not have known, and questions about what the police had done.
If the police had taken half measures, why they did so?
That's right. Why they hadn't pushed it further. There are two ways to look at this. One way says, look, It was SO13, I think it was, a special operations unit, a part of the Metropolitan Police, that does anti-terrorism and diplomatic and royal protection. Now, the reason they were involved in the case in the first place is because, remember, it started with hacking into the voicemail boxes of senior royal aides. Now, these people have to deal with, you know, terrorism, tube trains being blown up, you name it. So they could justifiably argue, I think, that they had rather more important things to do. On the other hand, there is the lurking suspicion that what really bothered them was what happened if you kept pulling at this piece of string, because the police and newspapers have relationships which, for good or ill, are frequently not disclosed, involve the handing over of information, sometimes money. So the conspiracy theory has it that if you keep pulling at this piece of string, something very nasty turns up.
Steve, I don't know if you saw Jack Schaefer's piece in Slate, but he posits that now that all these names of other hack victims have begun to percolate up and the litigation is beginning to flow, and because of the government inquiry into Scotland Yard's handling of the investigation and because of the media coverage, that all of that in time will conspire to get to the bottom of all of this.
I think that's probably right. I mean, there are a string of things happening. The police inquiry continues. How far that gets, we will see. But they're under quite a lot of pressure now to demonstrate they're doing it properly. There are three parliamentary committees going to look at it. And then the Press Complaints Commission, you know, which is the UK press watchdog. They all believe that they've been misled at some point in this process. And as you point out critically, there are the legal actions. Now, it is characteristic of some of these legal actions that they will quite likely have the capacity to turn up information which could prove extremely embarrassing.
Going right up to the Prime Minister?
Well, certainly up to his press aide, yes, Andy Coulson. The idea this could have happened in his newsroom when he hadn't got the foggiest idea about it, he's greeted with incredulity sort of left, right and centre.
Now, to the American ear, the notion of tabloid reporters eavesdropping on voicemail messages is pretty shocking, actually. I'm curious, in the UK, did it even raise eyebrows originally? I mean, Fleet Street's standard operating procedure is apparently quite different from what we are accustomed to here.
The idea that you might ride roughshod over somebody's rights to privacy and so on in pursuit of something that was justified in the public interest, that's not alien to the British journalistic culture. There was a guy called Benji the Bin Man, he was known as, who famously would hang around people's houses, and when they put their rubbish out, he'd go through the bins and he'd turn up all sorts of stuff. When people thought, hang on a minute, journalists might be hacking my mobile phone messages, even here, and we perhaps, you know, slightly inured to some of their tabloid tactics, that appeared right from the outset to be a step too far.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Steve Hewlett is a columnist for The Guardian and host of The Media Show on BBC Radio. Last month, a group of historians petitioned a federal court in Washington, D.C. to release Richard M. Nixon's 1975 grand jury testimony in the Watergate affair. Whether or not they succeed remains to be seen. But one thing is for sure. If Jack Anderson were alive and in his prime, he would, by hook or by crook, find a way to get his hands on those documents. Anderson was an investigative reporter whose syndicated newspaper column, Washington Merry-Go-Round, outed countless political scandals beginning in the 1950s. Anderson is the subject of a new book by George Washington University Public Affairs Professor Mark Feldstein, Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington's Scandal Culture. Mark, welcome to OTM.
I'm delighted to be here, Bob. Thanks.
Would you just list some of the big scoops that Jack Anderson came up with in his many decades of writing this column?
You bet. I mean, everything from American troops getting involved in the Korean War, he was the first reporter to break that, to virtually all of Richard Nixon's first scandals, the slush fund that led to Nixon's mawkish Checkers speech in 1952, financial dealings with Howard Hughes.
He caught Nixon using the IRS to achieve political aims. He caught Nixon's CIA and a major U.S. conglomerate called ITT conspiring to overthrow Salvador Allende in Chile. The list goes on and on, eh?
Oh, it does. And it wasn't limited just to Richard Nixon. Senator Thomas Dodd, the father of Christopher Dodd, Anderson for a year got employees to filch documents from his office, and he exposed the senator's corruption. More than 100 articles. It led to his censure, and he was a broken man. He broke the story about how the CIA and the mafia were in cahoots to try to kill Fidel Castro at the behest of the Kennedy administration. He broke the biggest stories of his time, stories that otherwise never would have come out.
Now, the central conceit of your book is that Richard Nixon and Jack Anderson led kind of parallel lives. They came to Washington at about the same time. They came from very similar backgrounds. They both kind of had chips on their shoulders. They never really fit into the Washington mainstream, and both were just ethically bankrupt. Tell me about Jack Anderson's, you know, ethical shortcomings.
Well, shortcoming like beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but there's no question he used tactics that I don't teach to my students in journalism school. He was not above using bribery, blackmail, participating in buggings. He believed that the First Amendment was divinely inspired. He was a devout Mormon, and that he answered to a higher calling than merely the law, that he answered to God, and that God was on his side. Nixon and Anderson both used the very same techniques that they decried in the other, and both seemed oblivious to the sort of moral contradiction that that raised, let alone the slippery slope that Anderson, as the righteous muckraker, had of lying to expose the truth, of stealing to expose corruption.
Tell me about the India-Pakistan War.
Well, Pakistan then, as now, was this very troubled, unstable, undemocratic country, and got into a war in 1971 with India. Nixon publicly professed neutrality, but privately, Jack Anderson learned, was secretly arming Pakistan and tilting U.S. policy toward this dictatorship. Nixon was lying to Congress, even lying to his own cabinet about this. How did Anderson know? He got a hold of real-time, top-secret documents, just a few weeks old, minutes that were taken of Henry Kissinger, Nixon's national security advisor, of his meetings with the president. And he published them day after day after day in his syndicated column. It drove Nixon and his White House crazy. And the tapes, which I've listened to in great detail, show Nixon's men trying to figure out ways to prosecute Anderson and having to back off when they learned that Anderson had even more dirt on Nixon that he was threatening to expose and effectively blackmailed the White House into not prosecuting him for espionage, which is what they wanted to do.
Nixon had often talked about neutralizing Jack Anderson, but suddenly the talk got extremely serious. Tell me about it.
They sicked the CIA illegally on Jack Anderson. 16 undercover agents spied on Anderson, his family, his staff. The Nixon White House concocted fake photos to implicate Anderson in wrongdoing. They sent him forged documents to try to get him to publish false stories. They even, at Nixon's personal direction, according to the tapes, tried to smear Jack Anderson as a homosexual. None of it stopped him. Finally, they turned to the ultimate form of censorship, and they plotted to assassinate him.
Now, that plot happily never came to fruition, but how close did they get?
A lot closer than anybody knew at the time. It got beyond just talk. E. Howard Hunt, one of the co-conspirators, did an interview with me before he died. I tape recorded it. And he admitted for the first time that he and Gordon Liddy actually surveilled Anderson from his office as he drove home, looking for places along the route where they could cause an accident, and that they then staked out Anderson's house in suburban Washington, looking for places where they could break in and put poison into his medicine.
Yeah, these guys were not faint of heart either. I mean, E. Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy were infamously two of the burglars who broke into the Watergate, the beginning of the end for Nixon.
In fact, it was just 6 weeks after the plot to assassinate Anderson was shelved by Hunt and Liddy in the White House that they instead broke into the Watergate Hotel. That mission was considered more important, more pressing. And you have to wonder, I mean, it's easy to laugh about this murder plot now. It seems so absurd. But had they been able to pull off that bugging, and Nixon would have been reelected in a landslide and no Watergate scandal to weaken him, could they have carried out this assassination plot? Would anybody even have known if Anderson mysteriously died? Would it just have seemed to be an accident?
All right, deal with the conundrum. He was a liar. He was a bully. He was a blackmailer. He was a thief. and at least aided and abetted in a couple of federal felonies.
Hey, nobody's perfect, Bob.
So is it better that we had Jack Anderson scoundrel for truth, or would it have been better if no such beast had existed at all?
I think it's better that he lived. You know, he was sort of the WikiLeaks of his day. He would not just get these classified documents and publish them in his column. He would hand them out gleefully at press conferences to other news reporters. I think he was a crucial check on wrongdoing at a time when the rest of the Washington press corps was docile and supine in the conformist days of the mid-20th century, because there was really nobody from the old muckrakers of a century ago between them and the sort of post-Watergate crowd of investigative reporting. And had he not been there, we would be poorer as a nation.
But it's hard for me to listen to that and not take that ends justifying the means prescription for contemporary journalists.
There is an inherent moral contradiction in lying to expose truth. Do I personally have the stomach to do it? No, and most reporters don't. But if we had had a Jack Anderson when the Iraq War was being planned by George Bush, maybe we would have found out earlier from secret documents only he could have gotten that the weapons of mass destruction that justified the war was a lie. Maybe we would have saved some of the thousands of casualties that occurred as a result. Is that worth stealing those documents? Is that worth telling some lies? Maybe it is.
Well, Mark, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Bob.
Mark Feldstein is author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington's Scandal Culture.
Now on to another contest between Nixon and a nemesis. This one waged out in the open in the inaugural session of America's quadrennial gladiator games.
Good evening. The television and radio stations of the United States and their affiliated stations are proud to provide facilities for a discussion of issues in the current political campaign by the two major candidates for the presidency.
Last week marked the 50th anniversary of the first televised presidential debates between Nixon and John F. Kennedy. Kennedy looked tan and healthy, whereas Nixon, one observer reportedly said, looked like a sinister chipmunk. Thus did U.S. politicians learn the importance of being telegenic. Ted Sorensen, who was at the debates as Kennedy's aide and speechwriter, told us that Kennedy's prep consisted mostly of being quizzed on information written on little blue cards, hour after hour, with one break for a speech, then more blue card sessions, then finally a rest in his hotel room. But as the hours passed and the debate loomed closer and closer, the candidate had yet to emerge.
Everybody was getting a little nervous. We were supposed to be at the Chicago CBS affiliate studio 1 hour before the debate, and it was getting close. So I was picked on to go wake up the candidate. Not an easy thing to do. So I opened the door. The light was on. He was lying there, sound asleep, covered in blue cards.
And when you woke him up, he was fresh as a daisy.
Yes, he was.
He wore a dark suit, so he stood in stark contrast to the light background, while Nixon was clad in gray, which faded into the walls. Much has been said of Kennedy's good looks, his confidence, his avowals of independence and experience, which reassured the doubters within his own party. But is TV, with its emphasis on style over substance, really the best forum for these debates?
People like to poo-poo Kennedy's style, so-called. It was style that helped him get his program through Congress. It was style and his appearances at the United Nations and on other world platforms that helped him build respect for the United States and its president. It was style that enabled him to establish communication with Nikita Khrushchev that, in the end, helped both of them avoid a nuclear holocaust at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I don't poo-poo style. I think voters should not cast their vote on the basis of looks. Style by itself is not enough, but I think television is a better indication of whether this candidate is going to be a successful leader of the American people and communicator of our values to the world. So, yes, I would keep the debates on television because that helps turn out at the polls. It helps educate people about the issues. That's democracy.
Former Kennedy aide and speechwriter Ted Sorensen.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, and Brett Jaspers. Sadly, we must bid farewell to Brett. Thank you very much for all your hard work and all best of luck. We had more help from Bonnie Watt and Nerida Brownlee, and the show was edited by Brooke. Jennifer Munson is our technical director, and our engineer this week was Robert Granis.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programming and our supreme leader. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.